Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by SuperTarget. Today, we talk with a master about what sets American etiquette apart from the rest of the world. Our guest is etiquette columnist Miss Manners. She also has some hints for striding confidently through the minefield of holiday entertaining. We have the beer for those who think they've tasted everything, from beer adventurer Steve Beaumont. Tea maven Bill Waddington brings us the year in tea and his pick of a gem for little money. Then we head east for mail order gifts from the Slow Food Guide to New York City. How about $6 for a food of the gods? And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. So, Jane, Michael, what are you guys up to?
We are heading south. We are currently in our Subaru sound studio, driving south out of New Jersey. We're in Maryland right now, waiting for a barbecue restaurant here to open up for lunch.
So you're literally on the road.
We are literally on the road in the car. I have stopped and pulled over. I only do this safely. I'm watching a cop get out of his car. He's looking at the door, wistfully waiting for the barbecue to open, as am I.
So, Michael, is Jane there?
Is Jane here? Yes, she's right next to me in the passenger seat.
I'm watching the cop go in the door here. He's very cute.
Oh, the place is open already?
Yes, it's opened up.
I don't know if we can talk to you, Lynn. The barbecue is just
open. Oh, come on.
This place is high on the copological spectrum. There's a lot of sheriffs and deputies walking in here.
Always a good sign.
Just stick with us for 5 minutes because I want to know, what's the latest discovery?
Well, the latest discovery is really a realization, and that is that the Northeast has some pretty wonderful chili. It's not Texas and it's not Cincinnati, but we've just recently, in the course of the last 2 days, had a couple of terrific examples of Northeast-style chili. The first was at a restaurant called Danny's Drive-In in Stratford, Connecticut. It's been there only since 1935. We just found out about it 2 weeks ago. But it's in what they serve is either hamburgers, hot dogs, or French fries, topped with this stuff called Kuhn's, K-U-H-N-S, chili, which is made locally. It's ferociously hot, so hot that when you order a chili dog or chili fries, the person behind the counter will offer you a little cup of Kuhn's chili with one French fry in it for you to taste to make sure that you're able to eat something so hot. But it's delicious.
Now, is it made very differently than the kind of chilies you find in places like Texas and New Mexico and Arizona?
Well, it is totally different from southwestern chili. In fact, it's probably maybe not even fair to call it chili because it's only a chili topping. There is, it's only suitable for topping other things, other sandwiches, hot dogs, hamburgers, French fries, onion rings, waffle fries. You would never eat a bowl of this by itself because it would incinerate your tongue. But on top of something else, it's really wonderful.
So is there any other place? You said there were other places.
There's another place called Rutz Hut, which I would love to talk about for its incredibly delicious hot dogs. But I think we've heard enough from me about hot dogs. I'm going to let Jane tell you about Rutz Hut chili.
Lynn!
Jane, hello, dear.
Hi. We're actually on the road. Isn't that exciting?
Well, this is great. So tell me about this Rutz Hut.
Okay, it's in Clifton, New Jersey.
Yeah.
And it's in the part of Jersey that I think you could fairly say is not the Garden State. It's in a very kind of industrial, commercial sprawl area of New Jersey, but it's been there a long time. And they serve probably the best East Coast chili, the kind of chili you eat in a bowl, not on top of a hot dog, that I've had in many a year. I mean, it is delicious.
What is the difference between an East Coast chili and a Southwest chili?
Oh, my God. I mean, you could, you know, start the next Civil War asking that question. But Western chili better not have any beans in it. It's a puree of chili peppers and meat, where East Coast chili is pretty much ground beef tomatoes, red kidney beans, and a whole rainbow of spices. And it's the spices that make a chili either good or bad. And Rutt's Hut has wonderful chili.
Well, okay, we've got two places. We've got the drive-in, Danny's drive-in, and we got Rutt's Hut. Guys, thank you for your communication from the Subaru studio.
This is the first time my mouth has been empty enough to do any communicating on this trip. But, you know, it's cold out, and you got to eat chili when it's cold.
Okay, well, now I'm going to release you because you're going to eat barbecue, right?
All right.
Which direction are you going after this?
I think we may head east to Virginia.
That would be west, Jane.
That would be west, Jane. All right, you see who's the navigator in this car.
A little geographically challenged, Jane, but that's okay.
Right.
That's okay.
To me, north is up, south is down, east is to the right, and west is to the left.
Well, good luck in Virginia, and thanks, guys.
Whatever the hell it is.
Yeah.
Stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern have a new updated edition of their classic guidebook, Road Food. Now, every week, you can hear them here on the Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, don't miss my new chili recipe. I call it Lynn's Nearly New Mexican Chili. Oh, and by the way, take a look at our new weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's all about easy dishes for work nights. There's a new recipe every week, my notes on some key techniques, and ideas for what to look for in the market right now. Now, you can register for it on the site, and hey, guys, it's free. A new guide is going to be hitting the shelves this spring, but I wanted to preview it now because it has some inspired gift ideas. The book is The Slow Food Guide to New York City, and its co-author is Ben Watson of Chelsea Green Publishers. Ben, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
So, Ben, can you give us a brief description of what the Slow Food Organization is about?
Sure. Slow Food is an international organization. And we promote traditional foods, regional foods, and artisan food producers around the world. And there are actually several thousand members throughout the United States.
Now, this guide covers solely New York City.
Yes, it does. Just the five boroughs of New York. And believe me, that was more than enough to bite off. It's
mm-hmm.
a huge, huge subject, as you can imagine.
Are these all really upscale kinds of places?
No, not at all. There's a wide range of places in there. Some are real hole-in-the-wall shops and restaurants, and others are some of the famous four-star restaurants or three-star restaurants that you've heard about and that you see in the New York Times or other places.
So how about some recommendations? Tell us about some of the entries.
Sure. It was really fun to think about this, too. And, of course, it's wonderful to go down to the city and walk around. But for people who aren't going to have time before Christmas or New Year's to do that, some of the places that have a web presence, one of the greatest places that I found in my tour around the city was Kosar's Bialy's. A Bialy is a kind of a flatbread that looks like a bagel, and it's made with the same kind of dough, so it's a very stiff dough. But instead of having the hole in the center, it has a little indentation. You press it down by hand, and you fill it with delicious, fresh, chopped, caramelized onions. So Bialy's are a wonderful thing. They're good with a schmear of cream cheese and some smoked fish. And Kosar's has been going since 1936. It's the oldest and generally regarded to be the best Bialy makers in the United States.
So they'll mail order?
They will mail order, and the prices, you were talking about the prices, and I know this year people are tend to be cutting back a bit because of the economy and various things, but you can buy a dozen Bialys for $6. In fact, I'm sure you spend far more on the postage than you do on the actual Bialys.
Oh, my mouth is watering.
But they also have wonderful bagels and sesame sticks and pletzels. Pletzel is the Jewish word for, I love saying that word too. It's the it's the Yiddish term for a flatbread, and that's really what a Bialy is. It's a small pletzel.
So what else? Another place.
Okay, another place that actually is quite close geographically to Kosar's is a wonderful place called Russ and Daughters. And they have the most wonderful smoked fish and caviars. It's a fourth-generation business, and it was established back in 1914. And if you go onto their website, you can get, for instance, a smoked salmon medley. They have lots of different kinds of smoked salmon from Scotland, and they have from Alaska, wild Alaskan salmon, pastrami-cured salmon that they make themselves there. Just a wonderful place. And the thing that made this interesting to Slow Food, we're also very much into biodiversity and protecting our food supplies. And they actually have, in addition to Caspian Sea caviar, which we don't advocate buying because of the problems with the depletion of resources, they have alternative caviar, wonderful red Alaska salmon roe. You can buy Caribbean flying fish roe with wasabi, so it's a delightful green color. It's just a great selection of products.
I've always wondered how you catch a flying fish to get the roe, but that's another issue. Any other places you'd want us to check out?
Sure. Another place, one of my favorite places for cheese in the city, is a tiny shop called Murray's Cheese Shop down in the West Village. They're on Bleecker Street in the West Village. And they have a wonderful website in which they have organized it by nationality. So you could look under American cheeses, British cheeses, French, Italian, Spanish. And they have collections, gift boxes, of six different cheeses, and they'll organize it from the mildest cheese to the strongest cheese. They'll give you a nice selection of them, or you can get a smaller selection of four cheeses. But I think the best deal that they have is they have a crock of cheese, a 7-ounce crock of cheese, Stilton cheese, wonderful creamy texture, clean, a lingering kind of a tanginess and a buttery quality. And it's from the Cropwell Bishop Dairy, which is one of the most traditional Stilton makers in England. It would be a wonderful present. And the best thing, it's under $20.
Under $20?
Yes.
I'm there. What about something sweet?
For something sweet, one of my favorite places for cheesecake in the city, New York is known for its cheesecake, and in the book we celebrate typical New York foods. And I love Eileen's Special Cheesecake. They're down on Cleveland Place in Little Italy, and they'll send a 10-inch cake, which serves 16 people anywhere in the U.S. overnight. They also make mini cheesecakes and lots of other things, but they have 20 flavors of cheesecake, including amaretto and various other kinds. I have to admit that my favorite is still the plain, and I think purists will agree that the best kind of cheesecake is plain, but you can actually order 12 assorted slices from them if you can't decide. Even better.
So once I have my flying fish, I've got the cheese, I'll get the cheesecake, and I'll just have a Bialy for dessert. Thanks a lot, Ben. Hey, have a good holiday.
You too.
Ben Watson is co-author with Patrick Martins of The Slow Food Guide to New York City. Now, it'll be out next spring, but you can get Ben's suggestions right this very second on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, etiquette expert Miss Manners, this year's deal in tea, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by SuperTarget, offering ingredients for your favorite recipes, from real semolina brass-cut Italian pastas to a wide variety of European cheeses. You can visit them online at Target.com to find a store near you. In honor of this holiday season, when we spend more time socializing with our fellow persons than at any other time of year, and just in time to save us from embarrassing errors of etiquette, we bring you the queen of the correct, the doyenne of the civilized, Miss Manners, also known as Judith Martin. Her Miss Manners newspaper columns appear across the country, and her books are bestsellers. Now, the latest one is called Star Spangled Manners, in which Miss Manners defends American etiquette for a change. Judith Martin, welcome.
Thank you.
Judith, how did you come to start writing about etiquette?
Through an interest in history, I found out that if you want to know what people were doing, look at their rules. Whatever they were being told not to do, that's what they were doing. Uh-huh. So in the 17th century, people were told not to blow their noses into the tablecloth. I've been able to skip that. That's one of the few things we can now take for granted, I hope.
It's not going to happen.
But you can presume they were doing it then, or they wouldn't have been told to stop.
Is there actually a definition of American etiquette?
Absolutely. This is what my book is about. It's the etiquette of egalitarianism. It is a rejection of the etiquette of Europe at the time that America was settled, because it was class-oriented and had to do with courts and looking up to your betters and down on your inferiors and a lot of other stuff we don't recognize. So the founding fathers worked on the etiquette problem, and we've been working on it ever since.
Well, in a matter of years back during the Revolution, you went from being a culture where you had a king and you had a class system, and then supposedly we were all equal. How did that change express itself at that time?
Well, the question was, how should that express itself? How do you keep the dignity and yet dispense with lavish ceremony and kowtowing and that sort of thing? George Washington cut down the entertaining considerably, because he lived in a time when people just showed up at Mount Vernon and then stayed a few months. So he put a few self-serving but excellent rules into effect, such as, we start eating at dinner time and I don't care whether you've shown up by then or not, which is not the way he put it. He said, my cook would be upset, so we have to do it for him. Then you had Mr. Jefferson going way over in the direction of, let's not make any distinctions at all. No seating plan, no everybody trying to get through the door at the same time. Even before he was president, taking the lowest chair at his boarding house. Even when people tried to argue that, okay, maybe his rank didn't entitle him to sit where it was slightly warmer. But didn't the fact that he was the oldest person in the room entitle him to anything? Nope. He was the first to say, no, everything's going to be equal around here, which, of course, didn't work either. And as I say, we're still working on it.
Well, let's talk about American entertaining. Do we have our own style of entertaining?
Well, you're talking about the traditional style, which was extremely hospitable, as befits a country where people are moving around and need help and need to make friends quickly. Or are you talking about what it has evolved into, such as cash bars and you bring the dinner, why should I pay for you type of thing? As always, our theory is better than our practice.
Well, speaking of you bring the dinner, what do you think about potlucks?
Interesting what's happened to that. The concept of potluck started out as, well, we have the pot on the stove, and if you drop in, please forgive us that we haven't made something special. We're very happy to have you share what we were going to eat anyway. And now potluck means the guests make the dinner. And it is a part of this resentment of the idea of hospitality and a lesson of traditional American generosity.
But isn't there a flip side to that, that many of us are living very pressured lives and time is very dear, but we'd like to be with our friends, and what we're saying is, why don't we pool our resources so we can come together?
Yes, as opposed to the old days where you had to cook over the fire and do the washing of the linens by hand and so on. Poor moderns, yes, we have no time at all. And back in the good old days, they had nothing to do but sit around. And so, of course, they could entertain. I'm sorry, I don't go in for that one. I've heard pressure as an excuse for practically everything in civilized life. Yes, life is full of pressures, always has been, but you have to decide what is important. And it used to be thought that having friends and seeing your family and being good to your neighbors was important.
Well, I'm going to move you to, you're sitting at the table, you're at a dinner party. Is it correct to stand up and help the hosts clear the table?
It is correct if there is no one helping at the table to ask whether the hostess or the host would like that. The person who pops up and takes over the kitchen is probably just as much of a nuisance as the person who sits there blind while the hostess alone tries to shuffle things on and off the table. It's nice to offer, but you have to be able to take no for an answer.
Okay. What about bringing the house gift? Do you always bring something when you're invited to someone's home?
I'm on the verge of making a rule that it is not correct. I am duly appreciative of generosity. However, what it has evolved into is the idea that that's their payment for the meal. They don't have to write letters to thank the host. They don't have to invite them back. They just hand something over. It's a nice impulse, provided that's all it is. It does not get you out of reciprocating.
Now, you mentioned thank you notes. Should we always send them?
And for dinner parties, yes.
Or for a party where there are many people, should you always send a thank you note?
Large parties, less so. But for a seated dinner party, it is still very much the custom among those who obey customs.
And can we do it by email?
Depends on the nature of the party. Email is a very informal means of communication. You can use it for people you know well. If you are going to some sort of formal dinner party, then a letter in your own dear little hand, ink on paper, and postage is required.
Ms. Manners, what do you see as the thing that is most difficult for people when they go out to eat?
Eating. This is astonishing to me because I wonder how people who don't know how to eat manage to grow up. And I'm afraid the answer is that they really didn't care whether they disgusted anybody around them, or perhaps there was nobody around them and they were eating out of the refrigerator. But people panic when they are about to go to dinner someplace where they care what someone thinks of them. You have to ask yourself, a society where the people don't know how to get food in their mouth must be a dangerous society.
But we're not blowing our nose into the tablecloth anymore.
Well, yes, there is progress. I have to keep reminding myself of that.
Ms. Manners, thank you.
You're welcome.
Judith Martin is author of Star Spangled Manners, in which Miss Manners defends American etiquette for a change. Tea merchant Bill Waddington has joined me in the studio. Bill spent the last two decades researching all aspects of tea, and he's always so willing to answer my questions. Bill, it's good to see you again. Welcome back.
It's nice to be here again, Lynn.
Bill, I want to talk about the year in tea. I realize tea changes just like wine does, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So what were the great teas?
The great teas this year are teas from Ceylon and the jasmine teas from China. Those are certainly the high points of the year so far.
So if I'm going out to look for them, what should I look for?
Jasmines are amazing this year. It's the first year I've ever cupped. I get dozens and dozens of samples of each grade of tea, and it's the first year where almost all the samples I wanted to buy in China jasmine teas, across the board, from everyday price jasmines to the really, really expensive Jasmine Dragon Phoenix Pearls, the hand-rolled jasmine teas. They're all marvelous. It's hard to go wrong with jasmine teas this year.
Okay. Are these green teas or dark teas?
Typically, either the base tea is either a green tea or a slightly darker green tea, a little bit more oxidized. It's called a Puchong.
Okay. Now, what about Ceylon teas?
Ceylon teas are across the board marvelous this year. And to be honest, looking at the whole tea industry, it hasn't been a great year. It's been an okay year, but the Ceylon teas are one of the high points. Again, at every price range, they've come out very full-bodied, very flavorful, and very unique. The Ceylon tea industry is doing all sorts of very unique, unusual tea processing techniques, more so than probably any other region in the world right now.
So what do they taste like?
They tend to be extremely full-bodied teas, as often as not, and with a little bit of a fruity note and often a little bit of an astringency, a little bit of a bite to them that can just be marvelous. But this year has been a year where many of the darker teas have not had the body. They've been thin, kind of watery, kind of spineless almost. The supposedly real dark, full-bodied teas have not been that this year. The Ceylon teas are the exception to that rule. So if you like a strong, dark, full-bodied, knock-me-in-the-head kind of tea with a lot of oomph to it, I'd look at Ceylon teas before anything else this year.
Okay. I hear the water boiling, Bill. Are you going to make me some tea?
I am going to be making tea from the Ratnapura region of Ceylon, which is in southwestern Ceylon. It's called Ratnapura Silvertip. It's a marvelous, dark, very complex flavored black tea that I think is just one of the best bargains and also one of the best, just best high-end teas from Ceylon that you can get this year.
You know, I have a real dumb question. Where is Ceylon exactly?
Good question. Ceylon is the large island off the southeast coast of India. And I use the word Ceylon, although technically Ceylon hasn't been called Ceylon since, I believe it was early 1970s when they gained their independence and changed their name to Sri Lanka. Except for matters of tea, in which case they prefer to retain the name Ceylon, the colonial name, because it was so synonymous with high quality. So in all other matters, people refer to it as Sri Lanka.
Oh, okay. Now I know what you're talking about. You know what? I can smell it over here. Can we have a taste of that?
We certainly can. Let me strain it off here so you can get a little bit of the flavor. And
I should explain. Bill's brewing in a little cup that has a lid, and the lid has a sawtooth edge so that he can drain the tea but keep the leaves in the cup. And now it's going into a tea bowl. This is the color of amber.
Yep, very much so.
It's a beautiful. And it has almost a faint, almost this faint smokiness to it. Slightly astringent, but a lot of that fruity quality you talked about. Bill, this is a nice cup of tea. Hey, thank you.
Thank you very much, Lynn. It's been fun.
Tea Authority Bill Waddington is the proprietor of Tea Source, a store in St. Paul, Minnesota. Stephen Beaumont treks the world looking for special beers. Now, he reports on his finds on his website, in his books, like The Premium Beer Drinker's Guide, and here on the show. Steve, good to have you back.
It's good to be back, Lynn.
So where has beer taken you lately?
Well, I just got back from Germany. And within Germany, I traveled to this little town in northern Bavaria, the area called Franconia. And the town's name is Bamberg, and it's famous for one specific style of beer, smoked malt beer.
Smoked? I don't think I've ever heard of a smoked beer.
Have you ever consumed a smoked ham in a glass? I mean, this is what smoked malt beer is like. It's wonderful stuff, and the origins of it go back centuries, if not millennia, because the way that beer is made is obviously from barley malt. And the way that you malt barley is you have to germinate it and then dry it out. And they dry it out by putting it over a heat source of some sort.
Right.
In the old days, that used to be a fire, a wood fire. So as you can imagine, the malt ended up tasting very smoky. And that's the kind of malt that they use for these smoked malt beers now.
So people in this part of the world got used to that very smoky flavor and they just started to accentuate it?
They're famous for it. These beers are recognized by beer connoisseurs around the world as not only some of the most unusual beers in the world, in the regard that they harken back to these old malting methods, mm-hmm. but also some of the most expressive beers. I mean, they really come at you with these wonderful flavors.
Well, now, all right, so I'm picturing, is this something like drinking a single malt scotch where you get that smoky quality?
If you can think of some of the really peaty malts from Islay, things like Lagavulin and Laphroaig, along those same lines. My personal favorite from Bamberg is this is a mouthful. It's called Ech Schlenkerla Rochbier.
It is a mouthful.
And Rochbier is the style of beer. That's a German term for a smoked malt beer. You can call it, anglicize it, call it Rauch beer or Rock beer, but you know that's the idea. It has this wonderful smoky aroma. It really is like putting your nose down on top of a smoked ham or something like that. It's really intense. And then in the glass, it follows the same with the taste. It's got this wonderful smoky flavor. It's like an Islay malt whiskey a bit. It's like smoked ham a bit. It's like, well, some people have said a bit like an ashtray, too.
Oh, my. Okay.
But in a good sense.
But other beers as well, and any production of this kind of beer on this side of the Atlantic?
Well, a number of years ago, a brewery way up in Juneau, Alaska, decided that they were going to use the Salmon Smokehouse across the road from them to smoke some malt. And they created the Alaskan Smoked Porter. Now, this is an ale, and the German ones are lagers, but the idea is the same. They use this wonderful smoked malt and give it this terrific, smoky, rich quality to the beer. It's a wonderful beer. Then the brewer who was working in Alaskan at that time moved down to a brewery in Oregon called Rogue Ales, and he's replicated the idea in a beer called Rogue Smoke. Every year at the Great American Beer Festival in Denver, these two breweries end up fighting it out for the best smoked malt beer.
Well, what would you serve with these beers?
Well, you know, there's really not a lot of foods that will go with a smoked malt beer when the flavor is that strong. There are other smoked malt beers where they're only using, you know, a very small portion of smoked malt, so you get a little bit of smokiness. But really anything out of the smoker. You know, if you have smoked steak and smoked game meats of any kind, stuff off the barbecue can be very nice with smoked malt beers, but that's more of a summer kind of thing. The other thing is a nice cigar at the end of the day with a smoked malt beer, that can be kind of nice.
Well, smoke and smoke.
Exactly.
Steve, thank you.
My pleasure, Lynn.
Boy, does that bring back memories. Stephen Beaumont is author of The Premium Beer Drinker's Guide, the world's strongest, boldest, and most unusual beers. Now, his picks of smoked beers are on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, guys, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. Which fruit is a symbol of hope in Christian art? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. From Einstein Bagels and Starbucks Coffee to Cheesecake Factory Cheesecake, Super Target, working to find a meal solution for you breakfast through dinner. Now, you can visit them online at target.com to find a store near you. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in just a moment. The number's 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, which fruit is a symbol of hope in Christian art? Well, it's the pomegranate, and it's in season right this minute. It's a romantic fruit if there ever was one. Pomegranates symbolize hope, fertility, and plenty. And I think they look like gorgeous red leather purses filled with rubies. The unromantic types call them seeds. Now, pomegranate tastes rich and sweet, and it's got this little tang. And I think they are the ultimate fruit for relaxing, because you can't just chop down on a pomegranate. You got to sit there and pop out those rosy seeds a few at a time. And I love to suck on them. Now, the seeds are gorgeous over just about any dish, especially holiday salads. Drink the juice, or you can boil it down to sauce almost anything from fish to meats to desserts. So here's some pomegranate basics. First, always buy fruit that is plump, heavy, and has great color. Now, for juice, just roll the fruit on a counter, you know, pressing it down, then poke a hole in it and squeeze very hard. Now, to seed the pomegranate, always work over a bowl. Cut the fruit into quarters, then bend back each quarter and pop out the seeds with the tip of a fork or a knife. Now, the seeds and the juice freeze beautifully, and a whole pomegranate will keep in the fridge for about 3 months. So try a pomegranate. We need all the hope we can get right now. We are opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to those phones. We've got Ann on the line. So, Ann, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. How are you? Merry Christmas.
Well, Merry Christmas to you, too, ma'am. How are you doing?
I'm wonderful. Thank you. Lynn, along with chocolate and champagne, fresh, never frozen tuna. Is my passion.
Okay.
Until recently, I had to import it from either San Antonio or Austin. But we have a new expanded fish market here, and they have fresh, never frozen tuna.
Oh, this is great.
And I have been searing tuna steaks for years and serving them very rare with wasabi mayonnaise.
Mm-hmm.
And now my fishmonger tells me that no, I should only do that with sushi quality yellowfin tuna. That other tuna may have parasites in it, and that would be a very bad thing to serve rare. Now, I never heard of such a thing, so I'm coming to you as my expert. Have you ever heard of such a thing?
Well, yeah, I have, but I'm not specifically about a specific kind of tuna.
Uh-huh.
But one of the real concerns with a lot of seafood that we serve undercooked is that we have, it's a possibility that they have parasites.
Mm-hmm.
And parasites go through different stages of development, so it's possible that you would never see any visual evidence
mm-hmm.
of them. And it's the old conflict that if you cook the fish, whatever kind of fish it is, until it's safe, which would be at about 150 to 160 degrees internal temperature.
Then I don't want to eat it.
That's the problem.
Thank you very much.
Now, I'm not up on the latest information in terms of different types of tuna, and maybe it's very possible that some are more liable to have parasites than others.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is the Seafood Watch at the Monterey Bay Aquarium website. They are mainly looking at the ecological concerns, things that are overfished and that kind of thing. And I've just drawn a complete blank as to another website you might go to about the safety issues. But you know what I would do? I would go, first of all, to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. They've got a website. See if they have any information. And then I'd go to the Monterey Bay Aquarium website, because if you look at their list of sources for all of their information, you're often going to find you know, groups that are looking at these concerns about health. You know, when a fishmonger says that to me, and that's something that they're selling, I'd listen. Now, if you know, you realize that if you go to out on the islands in Hawaii, they view tuna as being like the steak of the sea. You may want to, you may want to switch to organically raised beef and eat that rare. I'm sorry, darling. I just, you know, I'm better safe than sorry.
Yeah. Well, see, I had a physician tell me years and years ago that there is not any water left in the world that's clean enough to make it safe to eat raw oysters. And, you know, they're fine if you cook them, but just don't have them on the half shell anymore.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's the same.
It's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking, but it's unfortunately the way things...
It's a good way to die, though.
Well, yeah, I mean, you think of all the possible ways to go. But now think of the chocolate and the champagne. You still got that left,
that's
and that's plenty
right,
safe.
That's right.
Hey, Anne, have a great holiday.
Have a blessed time. Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you, dear.
Bye.
Goodbye. It's thorny, a real thorny issue, but I think better safe than sorry. It's no fun being sick. And there's so many other good things to eat. Anyway, you can reach us, 800-537-5252. Let's see now, who's up next? We've got Heidi calling. Hey, Heidi, what's up? What would you like to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about fresh lemongrass stalks.
Oh,
I just ran into them because I took a tour of Chinatown in Boston.
Uh-huh.
And our tour guide brought us into a market and gave us a great tour. I wound up buying some fresh lemongrass stalks. They're about 12 to 18 inches long.
Right, exactly.
And I've seen them in recipes, and I want to use them. But I'm also wondering, how do I store all the ones that I'm not going to use right away?
Well, you're talking to a woman who stocks up on them at the farmer's market every summer. So this is what I do. I freeze them, by the way.
But
because I never want to waste a thing, supposedly you take off these. For anyone who's not ever seen a lemongrass stalk, by the way, they are about, what would you say, 2 feet long?
Yeah, I measured them at about 18 inches long.
18 inches long, and they're very narrow. They're probably a half inch to a quarter, three quarters of an inch wide, and they have sort of the bottom swells a little bit, and then it's a long, dry grass. I mean, if you think of a cattail, it's almost that kind of long leaf that is crackly almost.
Yes, tapered like a candle and then has kind of a bamboo shoot interior.
That's right. Now, what you're supposed to do is remove a layer of that outer long leaf, and you use the bottom 2 inches or so, the part that swells a bit and you can feel it has a little softness to it. And that's supposedly what you mince up or puree and you use to flavor dishes. But I save the tops and the outer stalks, and I either dry them or freeze them because they make great infusions. They taste, you know, that delicate, lovely, perfumey lemon quality that lemongrass has. And if you steep that in hot water, you get lemongrass tea. And then I'm into my gelatin period at this point. If you take some Knox gelatin, some flavorless gelatin, you make the lemongrass tea, you sweeten it with just a little bit of sugar, and then you melt gelatin into it, and you make little cubes of it, and then you drop those cubes, you know, you put them in the fridge, make cubes, and you drop those cubes around a lemon ice cream, you know. Or a lemon sorbet.
Or with some of those lychees that I bought. I can together.
Perfect. Absolutely perfect.
Oh, I love that idea.
Okay, so here's the deal. You'll take them apart. You'll use the bottom 2 or 3 inches, 2 inches maybe. Chop it up. Tuck it in the freezer. Okay? And then use it however you want to use it. And then the rest of it, don't throw it out. Cut it up. Get that in the freezer. And then, you know, you can just, you don't have to defrost these things. Just pull it out and infuse it in hot water.
That's great. I will certainly put that on my menu for this winter.
Hey, Heidi, take care.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have Kate calling. So, Kate, what do you want to talk about?
Lynn, I would love to know how to make a really good Mexican pozole.
You mean the stew with the pork and the corn?
Yes.
Yes.
Our area uses hominy at the taquerias.
That's right. Well, what it is, hominy is essentially the English word for the dried whole kernels of corn that have been soaked in a lime water. Lime as in the what would you call it, like the stone lime.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that loosens the husk. It also, by the way, releases the niacin in the corn. It was a really important nutritional aspect of the way native peoples of Central and South America lived.
Interesting.
Yeah, that process which they developed, who knows, thousands of years ago. The pozole that I'm most familiar with is from New Mexico. Now, it may not be the same as what you know. I'll tell you how it's done there, at least one version that I know. In New Mexico, you rarely see tomatoes with chilies. It seems, at least in northern New Mexico, in Santa Fe, where I've spent some amount of time, you don't see that. This is what they do. They take a pork shoulder, because it's beautifully marbled and has wonderful flavor. You cut it up into maybe a 1-inch dice. You have some garlic, some onion, a little bit of oregano, and green chilies. And you simmer that with the dried pozole. Some people like to soak the pozole, being the hominy, being the dried corn.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because the pozole and hominy are the same thing. Pozole is the name of the dish, but it's also the name of the corn.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, confusing, isn't it, though?
Yeah.
Anyway, what you do is, some people like to pre-soak the corn overnight in cold water, you know, in the fridge.
Yeah.
I've seen people just throw it in. It takes a long time to cook, and what happens is the pork almost melts into the liquid, and you have salt and pepper in there, and the green chilies give it that sparkle, and it's this brilliant stew. And it's better made a day ahead, you know, and you can skim the fat off. It's the best stew in the winter imaginable.
Oh, it is. I will agree with you there, and it's not easily found.
Right, and I don't know if it's exactly the way you're eating it where you are, but it's worth a try.
Oh, bless your heart, Liz.
Hey, you take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. I have got a great gift idea for you. It's not a fancy thing, but it's so special. There's this man named Art Lang, and he has an orchard. He grows old and hard to find peaches and nectarines, and he dries them, and they come in just Ziploc bags, but they taste like nothing on earth. The name of the farm is Honeycrisp. He has a website, honeycrispfarm.com, and you can get dried nectarines and dried peaches, the likes of which you have never tasted. It is the neatest gift, and it's really kind of a tribute to the small scale and the really special. Now, by now, just about everybody has heard about heirloom vegetables and heirloom fruit. But have you heard about heirloom animals? We came across a mention of a project that's going on in Maine. It's the Kem Scott Rare Breeds Foundation in Lincolnville, Maine. And evidently, they have all kinds of interesting livestock. Well, we have the person who is working with this livestock on the line. Her name is Jenny Ashlock. Jenny, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
So, Jenny, what is this project about?
Well, Kem Scott Rare Breeds Foundation was founded about 8 years ago by Robin and Bob Metcalf. And the whole premise behind it was to bring to the forefront these rare breeds of animals that, just like the heirloom vegetables that you mentioned, are going by the wayside for the more productive, faster-growing commercial varieties that we find in most of our grocery stores. And most people would say, well, why is it important to save these animals if we can find ones that grow bigger and faster for our food tables? And the whole idea is behind biodiversity, that we need to maintain what I like to say, a genetic seed bank, basically, for our food base, so that we're not relying on just a few varieties, but that we have what is true to nature, a variety of genes and animals, mm-hmm, and foods that we can choose from and to enrich the world as it was meant to be.
So what kind of animals are you talking about?
Well, basically, they would probably look like any other cow or chicken turkey that you might come across, but it's their history that makes them different. So we have Kerry cattle from Kerry, Ireland, that are primarily a dairy but also a beef variety mm-hmm. called the poor man's cow because they were used by the poorer classes, up to Narragansett Bay turkeys that are one of the original crossbreeds in the country, and Ancona chickens from Italy. So quite a variety, and probably the most popular breed on the farm is our Gloucestershire Old Spot hogs that are these huge. They get up to about 900 pounds with big floppy ears that fall over their eyes.
That's got to be like talking to a building because, I mean, I think, isn't the average pig like 250 pounds?
It might go to slaughter, yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, they're pretty amazing. They really are, and they're very personable, too. They'll come right up to you. So we have some piglets up the hill right now as we speak.
Well, now, what is actually happening? I mean, are you using this for breeding stock, offering this to farmers and people who are raising livestock?
A little bit of both, actually. We do raise the animals for breeding stock, but we also do harvest some of our animals, I should say, like our lambs and some of our pigs. And people will say, well, why do you harvest them if they're so rare?
Yeah, exactly.
But the whole idea is that the animals need to have a purpose. And part of their purpose, part of a farm animal's purpose, is for food. And they have lost out on many of their purposes due to our commercial breeds.
Is there any way that people can get these foods?
Mm-hmm. In fact, just by contacting us at the farm, either going on the web, which is www.kelmscott.org, or by calling us here at the farm in Maine.
Okay. Jenny, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, sure, Lynn. Thank you so much.
Jenny Ashlock works with the Kelm Scott Rare Breeds Foundation in Lincolnville, Maine. Now, for information on the foundation and the animals, check out the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. I want to thank you all for joining us. Remember, call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this observation on entertaining. A host must be like a duck, calm and unruffled on the surface and paddling like hell underneath. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here and much more can be found on the website. That's splendidtable.org. Now, be sure to check out the Splendid Table store while you're there. All the proceeds go to support this very program. And don't miss out on our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Now, we hope it's going to help make your weeknight cooking a little easier. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.